This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, introducing Pete's E-Cups, letting you send a friend a cup. On the web at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
Be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, it's the third anniversary of the death of Olympia, Washington peace activist Rachel Corrie, who worked in Israel. Peace marches are planned around the region this weekend to protest the U.S. war in Iraq. And part four of the KBOO News Portland Alliance investigative series on the Portland, Oregon war economy.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,314 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 37,754 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 16th, 2006. I'm Eduardo Delanderos Tierre with my dog Cosmo.
And I'm Marlies Franklin. Today marks the third anniversary of the death of peace activist and Olympia, Washington native Rachel Corrie. At 23, Rachel was killed by a caterpillar bulldozer in Rafah refugee camp in the Gaza Strip while attempting to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home.
Israel maintains that the death was accidental, though eyewitnesses claim that Corrie, standing on a mound of dirt in a bright orange vest, was deliberately run over twice by the bulldozer operator. 2 months before her death in 2003, the Evergreen State College student had arrived in the Middle East to work with the International Solidarity Movement, a Palestinian-led organization founded in 2001, which works to resist the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land using nonviolent direct action methods. Last year, on the second anniversary of Corrie's death, her parents filed suit against the Israeli government as well as Caterpillar, the American company that manufactures the bulldozer that killed their daughter. The Corries contend that Caterpillar is violating national and international law by manufacturing specially made equipment for the Israeli government that Caterpillar knows might be used to endanger people. Corrie's death continues to be mourned and commemorated by peace activists worldwide. At 2 p.m. today in the occupied territories, at an Israeli-Palestinian checkpoint, activists from Anarchists Against the Wall, wearing red, paint-stained T-shirts, succeeded in lying down in front of the same model of Caterpillar bulldozer that killed Corrie. According to the Solidarity Movement, several Israeli contractors assaulted the group, resulting in injury to a journalist. In Portland, local theater artists will present a staged reading of extended excerpts from the new play, My Name is Rachel Corrie. The event takes place tonight at St. Francis Church at 330 Southeast 11th Avenue at 7 p.m. For more information on the International Solidarity Movement, visit their website at www.palsolidarity.org. Or to read Rachel Corrie's own words on the peace struggle, go to www.rachelswords.org. For KBOO News, this is Rochelle Saliba.
Portland City Commissioners this week voted to subpoena financial documents as part of an investigation into Portland General Electric's rates. Portland City Commissioner Randy Leonard criticized the utility for failing to voluntarily provide the information. Scott Sims, a PGE spokesman, told the Oregonian Wednesday that the city does not have the authority to examine the documents or even conduct the investigation. He said PGE will fight the subpoena. The utility says the Oregon Public Utility Commission and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission are the appropriate oversight authorities here. Under state regulatory guidelines, PGE has collected an estimated $90 million annually from ratepayers to cover federal and state income taxes. PGE sent its tax payments to Enron, where losses from other subsidiaries enabled the corporate parent to reduce its tax bill to zero.
Thanks, Eduardo. In a related development, PGE petitioned state regulators for an overall rate increase of 8.9%. PGE's rate increase proposal, filed yesterday with the State Public Utility Commission, varies the increase by customer class. Rates for residential incomes, customers would rise on an average of 8.5%. Rates for small commercial customers, 10.5%, and rates for large commercial and industrial businesses, 8.7%. The increases would generate $143 million annually, expanding total ratepayer revenue to $1.6 billion. PGE says its costs have, quote, been going up for years, unquote. This is the first significant rate increase proposed by the utility since 1991.
The draft Portland Public Schools plan to close 11 elementary schools was leaked to the Oregonian last night. Portland School Superintendent Vicki Phillips issued a statement this afternoon saying the plan was only a proposal. Phillips says the plan is not what she will propose to the school board. The leaked document indicated the district is also considering converting 27 elementary and middle schools to kindergarten through 8th grade facilities. School activists reacted with outrage, demanding that their superintendent take closures off the table for consideration. Last year, Portland's district closed 5 schools.
The Clatskanie School Board decided at a special meeting yesterday that it would take a full-time superintendent to replace Mike Corley, who will retire June 30th. The board had earlier discussed the possibility of hiring a combination superintendent-school principal to save money. Board member Karen George told the other directors that she had changed her mind about the combination position after researching and talking to other districts' superintendents. Corley, who makes $80,000 a year, is also the district curriculum director. Board member Stuart Haas said it was not practical in a school district of Clatskanie's size to have a building supervisor also be the superintendent. The school board met to approve a list of qualities and qualifications gathered last week from teachers, staff, and community members by the Oregon School Board Association. Eduardo?
Oregon's economic stake in war is higher than it's been since World War II. All this week, KBOO News, along with the Portland Alliance newspaper, airs the results of a 3-month investigation into how much our national addiction to war influences our state. Today is 4 of the series with KBOO's Lisa Loving.
Does the government offer funding assistance to manufacture this type of product?
Some of the areas I understand that they do. Department of Defense has grant money available for research and development of new products that could be beneficial to the DOD, and that's also an avenue that a lot of companies are here looking at.
That's an understatement, as this participant in Senator Gordon Smith's defense procurement fair last January well knows. Money for research and development is the holy grail of local businesses cashing in on Oregon's war boom. In fiscal year 2006, U.S. Representative Darlene Hooley won $13.9 million in research and development contracts from the Department of Defense for just 2 Oregon corporations. But Senators Ron Wyden and Gordon Smith were even more productive. They joined forces to bring home almost $70 million worth of defense contracts for nanotechnology research around the state. There's more. 2 Department of Defense groups, Small Business Innovation Research and Small Business Technology Transfer, also provide direct subsidies to companies and entrepreneurs developing defense technology. In 2005, the Innovation Research Agency spent more than $1 billion nationwide, while the Technology Transfer Agency spent $124 million. Is this money well spent? Peter Brugel of Oregon Peaceworks says no.
Every study that I've ever heard of has shown that if you take a certain amount of government spending, say $50 billion, and spend it on the military, it will create fewer jobs than if you spent that $50 billion on anything else in the economy.
Tom Hartung of the World Policy Institute in New York.
There's short-term thinking involved. There may be $1 million here, $10 million there, but it's going to come at the expense of cuts in all kinds of other programs down the road. Already we've seen there's going to be across-the-board cuts in the federal budget, and yet the Pentagon's only being cut 1%, and they're just going to take that money out of some emergency appropriation that they're going to ask for, you know, $50 or $100 billion for the war in Iraq. They'll just make good on whatever small cuts that they have. And no other part of the budget has that option of just saying, oh, it's an emergency in education, it's an emergency in health care, you know, give us a bunch of money in the middle of the year to make up for unmet needs.
Aside from stealing resources away from other needs, the Defense Department has another unfortunate side effect, pollution, as KBOO's Stephanie Potter discusses with Tom Hartung.
Well, depending what is produced, military firms can be among the worst polluters of any industry. And the Pentagon and the military itself is probably the biggest polluter of any institution in the country. So if you look at military bases, if you look at military companies, the possibilities of substantial pollution and degradation of the local environment is very high. There's a high possibility that that would happen.
Because there's not the same checks and safeguards.
Well, in many cases, military facilities aren't subject to the same standards of occupational safety and health and inspections by the Environmental Protection Agency. A lot of times the Pentagon sort of forecloses that and sort of handles it more or less on its own, which means we really don't have accountability about what's going on inside those factories.
Meanwhile, communities, groups, and organizations are coming out of the woodwork to compete for those research and development contracts. By any means necessary, as KBOO reporter Rabia Yeaman found at the Defense Contracting Fair.
My name is Ron Moat, and I am with the Northwest American Indian Development, PTAC, out of Seattle, Washington.
And why are you here today?
We actually help Native American-owned companies work with government contracting. So if they're interested in selling their products or services to a government agency, we'll help match them up with an agency that best fits them.
And can you give me some examples of Native American-owned businesses?
Actually, we have several here. We've got Native American Technology Corporation, and we actually presented them with an award, and they're an Oregon-based company.
And are they already contracting with the government?
Yes, they are.
And what type of product are they offering?
I want to say I'm actually not sure on them. Exactly what they. I'm actually new with the organization, so.
And are you yourself Native American?
No, I'm not.
Okay, thank you.
Tomorrow on part 5 of this series, Solutions. For KBOO News, Rabia Yeaman, Stephanie Potter, Martha Odom, and Lisa Loving reporting.
Around the world, people will gather this weekend to protest the war in Iraq and remember those who have died. KBOO's Jessica Perry has more.
March 19th marks the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Demonstrations, marches, and memorials are planned across the country and overseas. Many local groups have events planned as well, so if you would like to participate, get your pencils ready. Saturday, March 18th at 1 p.m., a Death of Democracy funeral procession will be held in Vancouver, Washington. Participants are asked to wear black and gather with their cars at the Fort Vancouver Library on Mill Plain and Fort Vancouver Way. Interested parties are asked to please RSVP by calling Edie Cotton at 360-750-7370. In Eugene, groups will assemble at 10:30 a.m. Saturday at three different venues, Lane County Fairgrounds Wheeler Pavilion, the Alton Baker Park Pedestrian Bridge, and the University of Oregon's EMU building. At 11 a.m., all will proceed and converge at noon on the federal building with a series of speakers and musicians. Corvallis Veterans for Peace and other peace activists will gather Saturday at noon at the Benton County Courthouse at 4th and Monroe in downtown Corvallis. All are welcome, and speakers will include elected officials and family members of service members killed in the war. Sunday, March 19th, there will be an End the War, Begin the Peace rally and march in Portland at Waterfront Park, north of the Morrison Bridge at Oak Street. Assemble at 1:30. The rally is at 2 p.m., the march at 2:30. Five communities will host Bridges for Peace events Sunday, March 19th, on each of the Columbia River Gorge bridges, beginning at 12:30 p.m. For information on other Columbia Gorge events, call Anthony Villa Gomez at 541-490-2106 or visit www.columbiariverpeace.org. Monday, March 20th, from 11:45 a.m. to 1 p.m., there will be a demonstration to end the war at Oregon Senator Ron Wyden's office at the Federal Building in downtown Portland at 1220 Southwest 3rd at Jefferson. For more information, call 503-327-8250. You can also find a partial listing of events in our area and across the country at www.unitedforpeace.org. I'm Jessica Rink-Perry, KBOO News.
Vancouver-based Columbia Land Trust is purchasing 120 acres in the lower reach of Lacamas Creek to guard the area from development. The nonprofit is putting $255,000 of its own money, together with $240,000 contributed by Clark County government, to buy the land. The effort will conserve important plant and wildlife habitat in an area near Green Mountain Golf Course and the fast-growing area on the northern fringe of Camas City limits. The Columbia Land Trust last week received $1 million, a $1 million federal grant through the North American Wetland Conservation Act. Using that money, the group also plans to purchase 380 acres of intertidal wetlands owned by the Port of Longview and a 250-acre island in the Columbia River near Tongue Point in Astoria.
The current time is 5:17, and now it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
George W.'s mind seems to operate in a bass-ackward fashion. When there is zero evidence to warrant a presidential rush to action, he plunges dead ahead, facts be damned. Yet, when there is an abundance of evidence on an issue crying out for presidential action, he sits on his duff and does nothing. As we now know, Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, had no connection to Al-Qaeda or 9/11, and posed no threat to our nation's security. But there we are, with our soldiers and country mired in Bush's bloody mess. Meanwhile, a new report shows that Greenland is melting in front of our very eyes. But Bush blindly insists that global warming is not happening, and therefore the U.S. should merely keep pumping out fossil fuel emissions, leaving the entire globe facing a disastrous mess. Using satellites, a research team from NASA and the University of Kansas has discovered the alarming fact that Greenland's vast glaciers are melting more than twice as fast as they were only 10 years ago. This is no small matter. The Greenland ice sheet is up to 2 miles thick and covers an area nearly as big as Mexico. Over the last two decades, the air temperature over the country's southern glaciers has risen by 5.4 degrees, causing a larger and faster ice melt that, in turn, is causing a worrisome rise in sea levels. In 1996, Greenland lost 22 cubic miles of its ice sheet. Last year, it lost 54 cubic miles. How much is that? Only one-fourth of a cubic mile of ice would supply all of the water that Los Angeles consumes in a year. This melt rate mirrors the findings of researchers analyzing other ice sheets from the Himalayas to Bolivia. This drastic change not only threatens people on seacoasts, but also means the globe will see more and bigger storms. This is Jim Hightower saying, would someone please take off Bush's blindfold and tell him to get his butt in gear? Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. tonight, hear The Proverbial Perspectives with Celeste Carey. She's going to interview the latest graduates of Portland State University's School of Nonprofit Management. Then at 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. Tonight's weather for Portland and Corvallis, surprise, surprise, rain with lows around 38 degrees. And in Hood River, cloudy and lows near freezing. Then tomorrow for Portland and Corvallis, more of the same, wet and cloudy. Highs of 50 degrees, and in Hood River, showers and a high of 48 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, of course, for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
A federal judge yesterday approved a $562,500 racial discrimination award to three black former employees of Lithia Motors Incorporated in Aurora. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission charged that Lithia Cherry Creek Dodge maintained a hostile work environment and retaliated against employees who complained. Lithia did not admit guilt in the settlement. James Witherspoon, Charles Mayers, and Roosevelt Williams, Jr. filed a complaint with the EEOC in 2003. Witherspoon alleged that a general manager who transferred to Cherry Creek Dodge from another dealership told him he would not tolerate, quote, BP or black people, the EEOC said. The general manager fired three black sales workers at his first staff meeting, the EEOC said. Witherspoon said racial slurs and other discrimination increased against him after he complained to the company, and he eventually was forced from his job.
The week-long Genocide Awareness Conference is wrapping up this Saturday with an interfaith dialogue and a peace and memorial vigil. KBOO's Judy Feistel and Michael Schuell interviewed organizer Katie J. Scott. Feistel first asked Scott how she got involved with the Darfur issue.
I heard Ruth Messenger, who's the president of the American Jewish World Service, speak last spring at PSU about Darfur and the situation in Darfur, Sudan. And I had just gotten back from Thailand working with dam-affected villagers in Thailand, and I was kind of grabbed by the situation in Darfur because of my experiences in Thailand.
Looking at the events, there appears to be a real focus on Darfur, but genocide is happening all over.
We kind of all came together under Darfur. We had bits and pieces of information, and so we wanted to be sure that people knew that genocide was happening right near at this moment. But we also wanted to bring light to all the other genocides that had happened really recently, such as the Guatemalan one that happened in the early 80s, as well as things that were happening in the early 90s, but also going way back to 1915, the Armenian genocide that is still not recognized by the Turkish community. And we wanted to be sure that everybody had access to information about all of those, because if people don't believe that genocide happened in the early part of the 20th century, then how could they possibly believe it was happening right now in 2006, and especially going on for the last 3 years? It needs to be stopped. And people thought after that Rwanda was a catastrophe, and that I can't believe we didn't get involved. Well, this is our chance. I mean, it's been 3 years.
How do you know about Darfur? What is your connection?
I don't have a personal connection with Darfur. My connection is basically through research. And just gather as much information as I can.
If Sudanese send you to Darfur, what are you going to tell them if you go? What are you going to do to them? Now your awareness of genocide, awareness in the Darfur, Rwanda, all over the world, to stop genocide.
I think if I was to go to Sudan, I would probably ask similar questions that Ruth Messenger and other AIDS workers go over there and ask. And what is your story? And what do you want people to know? And what do you want people to do for you? I would try to get out the education as much as possible, travel around, reach people that have insight into genocide and recognize that it is something that happens, but also trying to reach those populations that just have no idea what's going on, because those are the people that you can get to really stand up.
What do you see for the future after this, next week and beyond? Have you thought about that?
Our group has thought a little bit about that, and we're thinking of forming as a committee under the Oregon Peace Institute and trying to bring this to Portland every year, and bringing more information about different genocides and also more action steps. We'd like to actually do a lot more on healing and the healing process and what can go on after and the rebuilding efforts. That's something that we would like to focus on. In the meantime, April 30th, there'll be something in conjunction with the April 30th Washington, D.C. event that's held with the American Jewish World Service, and we'll try to do something here in Portland as well with the interfaith community. And we're just going to stay connected. Look for us at genocideawareness.net and Oregon Peace Institute, and we're going to continue our work until people are educated, until the genocide in Darfur is stopped.
That was Genocide Awareness Week organizer Katie J. Scott speaking with KBOO's Judy Fistel and Michael Schuell. For more information on the conference's remaining events, go to www.genocideawareness.net.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 16th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 203, or you can send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer is Martha Odom. Tonight's audio editors are Joshua Johnson and Miriam Widman. Special thanks to reporters Martha Odom, Rabia Yeaman, Stephanie Potter, Jessica Perry, Rochelle Saliba, Judy Fiestel, and Michael Scholl. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is our own Lisa Loving. And I'm Marlise Franklin.
And I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra with my dog Cosmo. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., here the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Their topic is theocracy and Christian hegemony. Then at 9, it's Marlene's Electronic Salon with Marlene Smith. She'll chat with Ed Goldberg about politics and culture. And then at 10, her guest will be the original mad cowboy, Howard Lyman. Of course, at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, your volunteer-powered, and your listener-sponsored community radio station. Gracias, paz y arte y chao.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, March 16, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The Bush administration calls Iran the greatest security challenge and reinstates the preemptive strike policy. In Iraq, the U.S. military launches Operation Swarmer, its largest air assault on Iraq since the 2003 invasion. And as the World Water Summit takes place in Mexico, we'll hear about the rain catchers of Rajasthan.
Nothing better happened in the village ever. The wells which went dry sprouted water again.
We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
From WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Cesarich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After a three-day wait, opening prayers kicked off the first session of the new Iraqi parliament today, where members were sworn in. Today's function is largely ceremonial, but there is incredible pressure on Iraqi lawmakers to create a unity government. Some analysts say the rapid formation of such a government could help curb the unrest brewing in the country. Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri may be willing to withdraw his nomination for a second term, he said today. Kurdish and Sunni political factions are saying that they would not support his re-election. Also, the U.S. military announced that it has launched its biggest offensive in Iraq since the invasion of 2003. We'll have more on Iraq later in the newscast. On Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives is poised tonight to pass a $92 billion emergency supplemental request to continue funding the war in Iraq and for rebuilding New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. Over $70 billion of the request goes to the war, bringing the total cost up to about $400 billion. Also on Capitol Hill, the Senate narrowly voted to raise the national debt ceiling to nearly $9 trillion. The move prevents the first ever default on U.S. Treasury notes. The debt limit increase is the fourth such move since President Bush took office 5 years ago. The move allows the government to continue paying for big item tickets, such as the war in Iraq, without having to raise taxes. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid.
The deterioration of the federal government's finances is the direct result of the misguided priorities of this administration and this rubber-stamping Republican Congress.
The $9 trillion deficit averages out to be about $30,000 per person. An Israeli incursion into Jenin broke out into a gunfight, furthering the recent hostilities between Israel and Palestine. Manar Jabrin reports.
An Israeli soldier was killed and another was injured on Thursday morning during a military invasion to the West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp. A gun battle erupted between Palestinian resistance fighters and the invading paratroopers, supported by 22 military vehicles, which entered the camp and searched scores of houses and arrested several civilians. Qadura Abu Musa, Jenin's governor, described what happened.
Today at dawn, dozens of Israeli armored vehicles invaded the city and surrounded the eastern neighborhood, firing rounds of live ammunition and clashed with the resistance fighters there. One Israeli soldier was killed and another wounded in the clashes. In addition, six residents were arrested. The army withdrew as the residents hurled stones and empty bottles at them.
In separate incident, two Israeli security guards were wounded in another shootout near a settlement adjacent to the West Bank city of Nablus. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the armed wing of Fatah, claimed responsibility for the shooting. This invasion came 2 days after the arrest of Ahmed Saadat, Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and five of his comrades in an attack on a Palestinian jail in the West Bank city of Jericho, which is a continuity of Israel's unilateral policy that will diminish chances to resume future peace talks. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Police and protesters clashed in El Salvador on Thursday after election authorities said that leftist Violeta Minivar of the FMLN had won the city's mayoral election race by a handful of votes. Police fired rubber bullets and tear gas when supporters of Minivar approached a hotel in the city where electoral authorities declared the final results after a delay. Officials also announced the right-wing arena will hold a narrow lead in El Salvador's Congress. Thousands of school and university students took to the streets of France's main towns and cities today in ongoing protest against the government's youth employment plan. And trade unions are hinting that they, too, may launch a strike. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Tens of thousands marched throughout the country today, in Paris, of course, and there were large demonstrations in the provinces, including Marseille on the Mediterranean coast, Bordeaux on the Atlantic, and in Rennes, a center of militancy in Brittany. Students' unions claim that 64 of the country's 84 universities are on strike. The education ministry admits to 58. School students' unions claim that three-quarters of Paris's high school students joined the strike. The Conference of University Chancellors meeting today declared that they share their students' concern over their future and called on the government to act to end the crisis. Government ministers have hinted that they might change parts of the scheme. Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin said that he's open to dialogue, which might improve it. But Bernard Thibault, the leader of the powerful CGT trade union, threatened to take the movement up a notch, hinting that he might call a general strike. And all the unions are calling for a massive turnout at protests scheduled for Saturday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
And I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration released a revised national security strategy today, calling Iran the greatest challenge and reinstated the preemptive strike policy adopted by the United States after September 11. Although some analysts think that the military strike against Iran is not imminent, strategy plans are being developed. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The national security strategy is required by law to lay out possible security threats to the United States. This year's is similar to that after September 11th, in which the president reaffirmed the policy of preemptive strike. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley spoke about the strategy.
We do not rule out the use of force before attacks occur, even if uncertainty remains as to the time and place of the enemy's attack.
The document also said that Iran is the greatest challenge of the United States. Although it did emphasize diplomacy with Iran, the document said that the U.S. will continue to take all necessary measures to protect our national and economic security against the adverse consequences of their bad conduct. John Wolfstaw, fellow of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, sees no connection between the revision of preemptive strike and the talk about Iran.
But clearly, the amount of attention that is paid to in the document to Iran is a reflection of what the administration sees as a continually worsening problem with regards to Iran and their nuclear ambition.
But Wolfstaw does see a lack of clarity in the administration's agenda for Iran.
It's a little ironic, actually, that in the National Security Strategy document, there's a lot of talk about the problems. Iran is a problem, North Korea is a problem, terrorism is a problem. And then they say, well, we'll use diplomacy and we'll use preemption if we have to. But that's not a strategy. That's a list of activities that can deal with following a bunch of problems. And what I'd like to see from the administration is a clear strategy about what tactics it plans to use and what, in fact, its bottom line is with regard to Iran. Are they prepared to accept some level of nuclear activity? Are they prepared to accept reactors but not enrichment? Are they prepared to bypass the UN Security Council if it's not forthcoming? None of this is clear from either the strategy document or the president's statement.
The United States, along with France and Germany, are pressuring the world to take some action against Iran over what they say is that Iran is taking steps to build a nuclear bomb. They have asked the United Nations Security Council to impose sanctions after Iran began enriching uranium at one of its nuclear power plants. China and Russia are resisting that move. In a major policy shift today, Iran announced that they will hold talks with the United States about Iraq. The U.S. has accused Iran of destabilizing the Iraq border and sending men to cause violence, something Iran has denied. But on Capitol Hill, debate persists over Iran. Although the Bush administration opposed sanctions, the House International Relations Committee yesterday voted to impose them. The bill would require sanctions against companies or countries that invest $40 million in Iranian oil. Democratic Representative Bob Filmer from San Diego is a member of that committee. He said Iran causes him to not sleep at night. He has his own plan.
But we're not helping them anyway. In fact, we're standing in their way. And we ought to get out of the way of the internal resistance and let them do what they can. Rather than invasion or appeasement, there is a third way, and that is helping the internal resistance.
The end result would be regime change. Ross Perzal is an Iranian-American political analyst. He says the U.S. is already beginning to use these methods.
The manipulation of Iranian exiles in this country and other countries, Iranian exiles who present themselves as defenders and lovers of freedom, democracy, and human rights, I think that that's a very worrisome collusion there that the U.S. is now beginning to fund on a large scale, these groups that are, it's a very unholy alliance.
The House passed today a request by the State Department for $50 million in democracy-spreading aid for Iran. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
The U.S. military launched its largest air assault on Iraq since the 2003 invasion today. The Bush administration employed more than 50 aircraft and 200 armored vehicles in the bombing campaign, codenamed Operation Swarmer, which the Pentagon says will continue for days. The area being bombed is near the ancient city of Samarra, home to the golden-domed Askariya Mosque, which militants blew up a month ago. Aaron Glantz has more.
Very little is known about this massive bombing campaign. The U.S. military will not say exactly where it's bombing, only that it's in a rural area northeast of Samarra, and that insurgents are allegedly hiding out there. At the White House, Bush spokesman Scott McClellan deflected questions about the assault.
Those are decisions made by the military. You ought to direct those questions to them.
So all that is done without consultation with the administration?
That's correct.
Samarra wasn't the only place bombed by the U.S. military today. U.S. warplanes flattened a house near Balad north of the capital. Family members and local police officials told reporters at least 11 people, including 5 children and 4 women, were killed in the attack. Meantime, in Baghdad, 24 more bodies were found, apparently the result of sectarian violence. Faris al-Azawi is a journalist in Baghdad for Iraq for All News.
The security is so bad in Baghdad, and it's very easy to get killed. So the government called for a curfew until 4 p.m. And even then, the Abu Hanifa shrine was hit by mortars.
Al-Azawi says the government also declared martial law Wednesday and activated a strict anti-terror law created during the occupation, which allows authorities to arrest people before they commit crimes and permits them to execute suspected terrorists on the spot without a trial. Again, journalist Faris al-Azawi.
And with all of this, there's no gas or electricity or water. You can say people are like a bomb that can explode at any minute.
On Wednesday, Iraqi authorities discovered at least 87 corpses, men shot to death execution style. 29 bodies, dressed only in underwear, were dug out of a single grave Tuesday in a Shiite neighborhood of Baghdad. The bloodshed appeared to be retaliation for a bomb and mortar attack in the primarily Shiite Sadr City slum that killed at least 58 people and wounded more than 200 2 days earlier. Fadl al-Shara, spokesperson for the Muqtada Sadr movement in Baghdad, urged against further reprisals.
The car bombs in Sadr City were made by the terrorists and by Saddam's supporters, and they want the situation to be so bad that the government looks bad. They want the civil war to break out, but the Sadr City people understand that, and they will never give them what they want.
At the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was asked if the discovery of the 87 corpses indicated the country was engulfed in a civil war already.
I don't even know the number's 87. I know the report says 87, but I don't know that that's true either, nor do I suspect you. No, how do you disaggregate that and say so many were in this category and so many were in that category? You can't know that. I don't know that, and I know I don't know that. And people who think they know probably don't.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold issued a resolution today to request the Senate to officially censure President Bush for breaking the law by authorizing an illegal wiretapping program. Censure has only been used once in congressional practice. The resolution was met with moderate support by the Democrats and is now awaiting a full hearing. Anastasia Genetsditska has more from Washington, D.C.
Senator Feingold began his news conference with the explanation on why he chose censure over impeachment.
Well, clearly I chose to pursue censure rather than impeachment, certainly at this point, because I believe at this point it's a way to help us positively resolve this issue. In other words, without getting the country in the middle of a huge problem like we had with the attempted Clinton impeachment, we have a passing of a resolution of censure, and hopefully the president would acknowledge it and say that he maybe went too far, and we would be able to move forward and stop worrying about this and get a pledge from the president that he's going to come within the law or make proposals to change the law to allow it.
It seems there will be few Republicans that would join Feingold's initiative, largely seen as a way to gain personal political dividends by a potential presidential candidate. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called it flat wrong, whereas Senator McCain said the censure would galvanize the Republican base. He added, however, that the move would not hurt his and Feingold's friendship.
I understand that he's liberal. I understand that he's from Wisconsin. But that doesn't prevent us from being friends. I don't let it affect my personal relationships with people. I think he has honestly held views. I vehemently disagree.
Feingold said that with his move, he aims to prompt his party to be more decisive on issues.
There is a tendency in our party, unfortunately, that we have to break through, to be afraid of taking a strong stand and stick to it. What the American people want are people that believe in something. And so when we go out there and do it strong, are strong and trying to have some kind of a timetable to end the Iraq war, that was a positive for us. But then we backed off.
Mark Raskin, the author of the book Democracy's Shadow, stated that the possibility of censure and impeachment is important as a means of ensuring accountability.
There is no way that anybody can control the executive. To take the most extreme case, the President of the United States wakes up tomorrow morning and says, what I want to do is use nuclear weapons against France in the interests of national security, because what's clear is that bad things are going on in our trade relations and we have to show them. There is nothing now to stop him from doing that, save the notion of being clear that impeachment can occur.
Feingold's proposal is moderately supported by the Democrats. Senator Carl Levin, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, said he believes Bush's program is wrong, but said he would rather wait for the investigation by the Intelligence Committee to be completed. Senator Feingold said he is hoping to organize a committee, debate, and vote on his censure resolution. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditskaya in Washington, D.C. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. The World Water Summit is underway in Mexico City, where participants are tackling such water issues as water contamination, privatization, and availability. While aquifer depletion remains a major issue around the world, as more wells tap into rapidly decreasing groundwater reserves. In places like Yemen and Iran's agriculturally rich Shanaran Plain, the water table is dropping by about 9 feet per year. Smaller drops elsewhere still raise concerns about water table sustainability. Lira Bardis looks at how people in an area known as the Palouse, located in eastern Washington and northern Idaho, are dealing with their declining aquifer.
The Palouse is a vast, non-irrigated agricultural expanse of rolling hills that straddles the Washington-Idaho state line and has much less rainfall than people associate with other northwest locales like Seattle. The two largest communities, Moscow, Idaho, and Pullman, Washington, get most of their drinking water from the deep Grand Ronde Aquifer. But the water table is declining by more than a foot per year, raising questions about the future as the population grows. Jerry Fairley, a hydrogeologist with the University of Idaho, is involved in one of several research projects.
We're trying to find out, how is water getting into the aquifer? Is there recharge coming in, or is there not any recharge coming in?
Mark Solomon, a county geotechnical drilling coordinator, says recently drilled test wells have seriously called into question earlier assumptions about the area's water table. He says we may never know the true extent of the region's deep aquifer resources.
Why? It's vast. It's based on the Columbia Basin, basalt flows that underlie most of central and eastern Washington, our area. And we are located on the very, very, very fringe of that basalt. Fringes feel effects first. Think of your fingers in a cold snap. Picture Moscow at the end of those basalt fingers. Pullman's just a little bit closer to the heart.
Solomon takes issue with the local intergovernmental group, the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee, because they have continued to focus on the possibility of deep aquifer recharge. Instead, he says, the area needs a water budget. Then incentives for conservation need to be legislated on both sides of the state line, buying time to develop other options.
Moscow can and should focus on capturing the abundant precipitation of the eastern basin while reducing its pumping from the deep aquifer, releasing more aquifer water for use in Pullman, which doesn't have those same options that Moscow does.
Pullman, Washington would have to help with the cost of building reservoirs in Idaho, and this type of funding across state lines is always politically complex. Hydrogeologist Fairley agrees an investment in surface water is needed, but notes reservoirs and associated treatment facilities are expensive.
The real question we want to ask, though, is not how much money do we have to invest to use surface water, but what is the cost of maintaining good quality aquifers, of maintaining a good quality environment? And when you look at it that way, the cost of using surface water is a minimal investment in our environment.
Conservation is the other part of the equation. Diane French is with the Palouse Water Conservation Network.
Any kind of planning has to shoot for a flat line on the curve, a net zero gain in water used. So when we have a new development, we need to ask them, how much do you plan to use in this development, and how do you anticipate reducing overall use in the community?
A possible model comes from the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is located in an arid climate with recent droughts. Santa Fe uses surface water and owns wells in town and 25 miles away. Assistant Santa Fe City Attorney Kyle Harwood says the city does not easily issue new building permits.
If a builder comes and says, I want to build 10 new homes, we say, all right, you need to go out and do 80 toilets. Bring us evidence that you've retrofitted 80 toilets, and they bring us the paperwork when we go out and field check.
Does that sort of program help create a sustainable water supply?
We've seen total water demand go down while we know we've had an increase in the number of connections. The problem is that there's about five or six interconnected factors, and it's very, very hard to tease out exactly which factor is having how much of an impact.
Those involved in water issues say the Palouse area's problems are typical of those around the country, particularly in the U.S. West, where it's said whiskey's for drinking and water is for fighting. Today, the fights are often among lawmakers and lobbyists. Idaho is considering controversial legislation to divert water used to generate electricity to recharge southern Idaho's vast Snake River aquifer, which serves nearly a million people. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Moscow, Idaho.
The 20th century opened eastern Rajasthan, known as the dirtiest state in India, to marble miners and loggers who decimated its forest and damaged its watershed. Its streams and rivers dried up first, the farms went next. Dangerous floods accompanied the monsoon rains. Overwhelmed by these calamities, villagers abandoned their farms. As men shifted to the cities for work, women spirited frail crops from dry ground and walked several kilometers a day to find water. Vinod K. Jones has more.
For many years, Gopalpura village did not see the weekly village market. For decades, this was a barren land. Drought and water scarcity drove the villagers to faraway cities as migrant laborers. Now life has come back in Alwar, thanks to a water movement started in 1985. Rajendra Singh, chief architect of the movement, received the prestigious Magsaysay Award in 2001. It was the recognition of his work.
This whole area was barren, a dry land. Nobody cultivated in the farms. Farmers migrated to the cities. Drought was the reason.
That displaced the force because no water here. No drinking water here, no water for agriculture, no water for the drinking water. For anyone, nothing is here. Just the old people is here, old women and old men is here, and some children here. Yes, they are working in the city, so they are creating the pressure on the cities. And that migration is forced migration, not voluntary migration.
Rajendra Singh initially came to eastern Rajasthan, one of the most underdeveloped areas in the country, to start literacy classes. But he faced a cold response by the villagers. Manku Meena, a senior tribal leader, told Singh, people will turn to education only when they become water sufficient and lives are stable. The tribal leader asked, can you fetch water back? It's a seemingly simple two-step program. First, catch rainwater by building small water catchments in the valleys and the plains, and second, revive vegetation on barren hill slopes. All this recharged the groundwater, and the people of Alwar turned it into a movement that spread beyond their village. They built over 8,000 earthen check dams in over 900 villages. They also revived five rivers that had gone dry. Raja Meena does not remember his age, but villagers say he is close to 100 years old.
Nothing better happened in the village ever. The wells which went dry,
sprouted water again. Vegetables started growing in the farms. Groundwater levels increased drastically. The men who migrated returned back. It had multiple effects.
They revived many abandoned ponds. The village ponds are the swimming pools for the community. Anand is a young farmer.
We feel proud to see our village green. The pond is full of fish. It is a sign of prosperity. We get better marriage proposals too.
Or loudspeakers address water parliament. The villagers are the parliamentarians. This particular meeting is called to declare the nearby forest a natural sanctuary. And the president of the parliament is Arjun Gujjar, a 60-year-old farmer.
Trees grew after we built the dam 15 years ago. Now the forest has come back in the hills. So are the loggers. We shall be keeping this forest as a public sanctuary and protect it forever.
At the end of the parliament, they formed a people's army to deal with the loggers. They don't trust the government to protect the forest. Hence the village army. For them, nature is their life. For FSRN, I am Vinod K. Jose in Alwar, Rajasthan, India.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Today's headlines editor is Mitch Jezerich at WBAI in New York, sitting in for Shannon Young. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 16th of March. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A former senator from Colorado could be the first Native American to head the Department of the Interior if President Bush takes the recommendation of some state senators to appoint Ben Nighthorse Campbell to the position. Maeve Conran has details.
Friends and political colleagues of former Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell are recommending him to President Bush to replace outgoing Interior Secretary Gail Norton, who resigned last week. The biggest push comes from Senator Wayne Allard, a Republican from Colorado and longtime friend of Campbell. On Tuesday, Allard endorsed Campbell in a letter he wrote to the president. Allard cited Campbell's work in chairing the Indian Affairs Committee and his interest in land, water and energy issues, areas which he would oversee if appointed head of the Interior Department. Campbell has also received support from Senator Ken Salazar, a Democrat from Colorado, and Senator Ted Stevens, a Republican from Alaska. Campbell, who served in the U.S. Department of Representatives as a Democrat for 6 years, was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1992, where he served until 2004, when he retired. He switched his allegiance to the Republican Party in 1995. If chosen for the position, he would be the first Native American to head the department, which is responsible for, amongst other things, the management of Indian trust fund accounts. The White House has not commented on the nomination. For Independent Native News, this is Maeve Conran in Boulder, Colorado.
Indigenous wild rice has been disappearing from Wisconsin lakes for decades. Now two Native American middle school students in Madison have launched a project to help restore it. They're heading to an international water conference in Mexico this week to share their research with students from 70 countries. On Monday, the girls got a traditional Ojibwe send-off. Gil Halstead was there and files this story.
The Grindstone Lake drummers from the Lakota Ray Reservation set the tone for the going-away party at the Spring Harbor Middle School. For 7th graders Katie Allen and Tessa Begay, the cultural awareness part of their project is just as important as the scientific work they've been doing on restoring wild rice beds in Nadison Lakes. Allen says she's looking forward to teaching her peers from around the world about the culture and ecology of rice.
The wild rice is like a filter which would collect all the pollution and stuff in the lakes. We want to teach it how it's our culture and how it helps water. Wild rice is like our main food.
So far, Allen and Begay have planted pilot rice beds in one local Madison lake and plan to expand the project next year. Madison teacher Patty Christie is a Lac du Flambeau tribal member. She says the goal is for these two teenagers to be a catalyst for enlisting other schools in similar projects.
We're gearing them up to teach our young ones so they can go back into the younger schools and be able to show them this is what we've done and you can do more.
The two girls represent the Lac du Flambeau and Lakota Ray reservations, but members of other Wisconsin tribes are also excited about the project. Menominee elder Shaggy Dodge sees the trip to an international conference for these two young Native girls as a way to challenge stereotypes about American Indians.
It's really good that these girls are getting to go to represent who we are and we do, because a lot of people think, you know, we're savages and we live in teepees and, you know, we're on welfare, and now they think we live off casino money. So I think it's a good representation.
At the conference, the two girls will help draft a children's water manifesto for countries around the world to work on. Funding for their trip to Mexico and for three other North American students comes from the bottled water company, Nestle's Waters. Gil Halstead, Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.